This is Rotunda Ramblings, a podcast from the PLS Reporter covering issues related to Pennsylvania state government. My name is Jason Gottesman, the Harrisburg Bureau Chief of the PLS Reporter. On this show, we're going to be talking with some folks from the from Dauphin County and the County Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania about the Health Choices Behavioral Health Program and how that's going at the local level and what more can be done to provide more funding for those suffering with developmental disabilities, mental illnesses, and or substance abuse challenges that are currently being served by the program. And the program is now in its 20th year, so we will be talking to them about that very shortly. But before we do, just going to go over some of the news from the week. And guess what? Well, probably 4th or 5th or 6th or 7th or, I don't know, lots of weeks now, the state budget is taking paramount news in terms of what's going on at the state capitol. And you kind of got to be a stranger to these things if you didn't know that the Pennsylvania Senate this week did pass a revenue package, then sent it to the House that would balance the 17-18 budget and close out the 16-17 budget. And actually, according to some people, put the state on a pretty good track for balancing the 18-19 budget as well. So lots of stuff that is a lot of stuff that is going on right now. That will put some pressure on the House at least to consider this plan. Now, again, this plan is led by the adding a gross receipts tax to natural gas, so at the consumer level, as well as increasing the gross receipts tax for electric consumption and telecommunication services. So that's about, they're expecting about $405 million from that next year, should this plan be what goes through. There's also, for the first time, a serious talk about a severance tax, which is something that Southeastern Republicans have really said is necessary for them to support any revenue package. So that's 2 cents per 1,000 cubic feet of natural gas produced. That's the tax. And then there's a hold harmless for the impact fee. So they're only expecting about $80 million from that next year. There's the PJM tax. There's a new tax on fireworks. There's a closing of a sales tax loophole for third-party vendors selling on Amazon and eBay and stuff like that, too. So that the revenue package is pretty comprehensive in terms of the things that it touches. It's about $570 million in recurring revenue. They're also booking about $200 million in recurring revenue from gaming expansion, which has yet to be considered, which they hope to bring up once they have agreement with the House. There is $1.225 billion in borrowing that's securitized by the Tobacco Settlement Fund to close out 16-17. Now, payments for that are not due for 2 years. But when they do, of course, the interest costs and stuff will put that about $3 billion that the state will have to pay back. But, that does close out the books. And then, of course, if there's, good economic times, a general fund can be used to pay that back as well. The pressure really now turns to the House, who basically said in a memo, leaders told their rank and file members in the House on Thursday that they don't expect for this plan to be rubber stamped by any means, that they will be deliberative in their process of considering it. And while they should be coming back before the end of August in order to consider the plan, they aren't necessarily going to be just moving this plan right on through. So it looks like there's going to be a couple weeks here of break and some deliberation. And I think Senate President Pro Tem Joe Scarnati, in remarks to us and a few others on Thursday, basically said, the state treasurer has come out and said that in September, the state will not be able to write checks anymore. And he along with others feel as though that will put some pressure on the House to act on this plan and move it along to the governor, who has signed off on that. So, this is put things in an interesting position, especially since over the weekend, since we did not cover this on the last podcast, the House, in a plan led by Speaker Mike Terzai, was unable to lift a no new revenue, no new tax spend or revenue plan, and things kind of crumbled on that Saturday afternoon, and the House sent their members home. So, this is, the next best option in terms of what's going to be coming up here and what's going to be considered over the next couple of weeks. So definitely something we're going to be keeping an eye on as we go through. And speaking of Speaker Terzai, our multimedia reporter, Kara, this week did a good news package on a protest trying to call Speaker Mike Terzai out for sending members home and asking them to him to have them return so that they can consider this revenue package. She's also working on some longer term projects, which we hope to have up here in the next couple of weeks. In terms of our Pittsburgh Bureau. There's a lot of things going on as Pittsburgh City Council wraps up their session here for the summer. They take about a 2 or 3 week absence here, so we have a lot of good material on a lot of sort of that flurry of activity before they take a couple week break. So there's that going on as well. And Kara has some interviews with Representative Patty Kim that are good video content. As well as Senator Judy Schwenk. Representative Kim talks about her bill to raise the minimum wage to $15 per hour by 2024. And Senator Schwenk talks about her legislation to prevent surprise billing from healthcare providers. Our intern Kyle, who has wrapped up for the summer, did a reflection piece looking back at AFSCME's role in the passage of pension reform legislation. We again have that budget coverage as well. So check all that out on theplsreporter.com. And without much further ado, we are going to be getting to our discussion about the Health Choices Behavioral Health Program and what will be happening with that going forward and how that has looked in the past. So here we go with that talk. Okay, we're here with Dan Eisenhower from Dauphin County and Jack Carroll from the County Commissioners Association. And we're talking about the Health Choices Behavioral Health Program. Whichever one of you wants to start off is fine, but why don't you just kind of go over what this program is. I guess it serves 2.4 million Pennsylvanians with mental illnesses, developmental disabilities, or substance abuse challenges.
Dan, I'll let you take the lead with this.
Sure, I'll go first. So the Health Choices program is now a 20-year-old program. It is what's called a mandatory Medicaid managed care program. So 20 years ago, Pennsylvania got permission from the federal government to implement a managed care program for people with medical assistance in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. It has two parts, physical health component and a behavioral health component. We're here today to talk about the benefits of county partnership with the Commonwealth and with private providers for the behavioral health component of Health Choices.
Sure. So why don't you just kind of go in a little bit more in depth on this. Is this something that is run by the state and then managed by the counties, or how does that work?
Right, so in Pennsylvania, there's this option that is called the county right of first opportunity, which means a county could submit a proposal to the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to either directly operate the behavioral health program, mm-hmm. or to partner with a private MCO, or they even have the option to say, no, we don't want to do it, and we will let the state contract and implement Health Choices in my county. Most counties took the right of first opportunity, submitted proposals, and therefore the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania executes a contract with the county to manage and operate the Health Choices program. And then again, counties' options are to do it directly themselves, or to partner with a private managed care organization.
Doing some reading on this, it seems like the change back in 1997 from the fee-for-service model wasn't working out so well. So why don't you talk about the transition as to why this is better than the previous program?
Well, under fee-for-service, really nobody was managing the care, mm-hmm. physical health or behavioral health. And so this was Pennsylvania's way of injecting a managed care approach into its medical assistance program. And they recognized that when it came to behavioral health services, mental health and substance abuse treatment services, that counties already held a great deal of responsibility for managing those types of programs at the county level. It made sense to also enlist counties in helping to manage the same types of services, mental health and substance abuse, for medical assistance recipients.
Right, and one of the big benefits, and one of the reasons that Pennsylvania made the decision to do Health Choices in the first place, was the annual growth of the medical assistance program was considered at the time to be unsustainable. There were year-over-year increases in the fee-for-service system that were unsustainable. And so one of the goals of the Health Choice, well, the three main goals of the Health Choices program from day one have been to control costs, improve access, and improve the quality of care. And you might, those three things might sound like impossible to do, and yet we have a 20-year history of compared to the fee-for-service system, controlling costs, improving access, and improving the quality of care. So we've actually been meeting those goals.
Well, so how do you do that? Because that seems like a struggle for all governments at any level with whatever programs they run.
Again, I think it helps that counties are already actively engaged in managing county-funded and county-managed mental health and substance abuse services. And so there are a lot of consumers who will transition between county-funded and medical assistance-funded, and having the same organizations involved in managing both helps for a seamless transition whenever those occur, so that somebody doesn't get lost through the cracks. I think that has helped contribute to a greater access. One of the things that I'm aware of is that since counties have been engaged through Health Choices in managing the behavioral health benefit, the penetration rate of medical assistance recipients actually accessing behavioral health services has increased.
Right, and one of the ways, I mean, I'm not blaming providers, so don't interpret this way, but in the fee-for-service system, which was unmanaged, essentially, there were no limits or controls placed on the delivery of services. And so that's what an unmanaged system is. What a managed care system does is try to target the most expensive services to the people that really need them, and to try to offer access to preventative services and sort of what we call entry-level services. So we dramatically increased accessibility to what we would call entry-level services, which avoids higher-cost services down the road. So in the case of both mental health and substance abuse services, inpatient tends to be, and residential tend to be, our most expensive services. And so if we can get more people into outpatient level of care, community-based level of care, we can serve more people more efficiently and try to avoid costly inpatient and residential services. And that's the basic model, and it's proved to work pretty well.
And what Dan has just described is how we've been able to accomplish one of those three goals of managing the growth of medical assistance costs, or containing those costs.
Right, so even though there's more people in the program, we can serve more people in an outpatient or partial, or like I call it, community-based level of care, than we can if they were accessing inpatient or residential services.
How much has this program evolved over the last 20 years? Are you finding more counties taking the option of taking ownership of this, or still some relying on the state, or how has that progressed?
I think from the get-go, most counties took advantage of the opportunity to be involved in managing behavioral health benefit of medical assistance recipients. In terms of how the program's evolved, I think what's maybe more relevant is we have been able to encourage providers through incentives to implement evidence-based practices, and thereby expand the range of services and the quality and the effectiveness of the services. Those are my thoughts on that, Dan.
Well, I was going to say that, plus this really is an example of, I think, one of the best partnerships between state government, county government, and the private sector.
Right.
It really is, because the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and the Office of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services has really worked with counties to not only sort of emphasize what Jack talked about, which is evidence-based practices and programming, but also opportunities for what we call reinvestment. So one of the benefits of counties running these programs is we do not make a profit on this program. If there are any savings that come from our ability to manage care, we literally reinvest those savings into new programs and new service opportunities. And this is where, I mean, the Commonwealth has been a really good partner. They've worked with us to allow us to expand new services, develop our own ideas of what kinds of reinvestment services meet local needs. And so almost all counties have implemented reinvestment services tailored to their individual communities. And so that requires some flexibility at the state level and also some creativity at the local level. And, you know, that's one of the big benefits.
Jason, can I give you a couple examples of that?
Sure.
In the DNA field, of the drug and alcohol field right now, I think everyone knows that we are completely overwhelmed.
Yeah.
With the extent of the current opioid health crisis. But two different reinvestment-funded initiatives that we've been able to put in place through our Capital 5 Health Choices Program involve expanding access to and increasing the effectiveness of medication-assisted treatment services for individuals with an opioid dependence. Mm-hmm. And the first one of those programs was to hire an organization called the RAISE Project to provide case coordination services for individuals receiving buprenorphine or Suboxone, one of the forms of medication that can be used with folks with an opiate dependency. The concern we had with that is that while the medication was promising in helping to control someone's cravings and addiction to an opiate, we wanted to make sure that patients were not just using the medication, but were also following the best practices of engaging in treatment and recovery support services at the same time. And so we implemented a pilot project with reinvestment funding using folks in recovery to provide case coordination. It proved to be effective, and we eventually folded that in as a supplemental service in our program. More recently, we've added a similar reinvestment project using the same provider, the RAISE Project, to replicate the same types of services with another form of medication that's being used in increasing frequency to treat opioid dependence, and that is Vivitrol, a monthly injection of naltrexone. And the same issue applies. The medication is great, it's very promising, but it's never intended to be the solution in and of itself. We need it to be used in accordance with best practice standards, and once again, that is making sure that individuals using naltrexone are also taking advantage of treatment services and recovery support services.
Right, and across the Commonwealth, there is just this extensive list of what I call creative and innovative programming that addresses mental health needs for children, adolescents, and adults, and also substance abuse services. Like I said, it's been a great opportunity to, and again, one of the advantages of counties is counties can address their local needs through the reinvestment of these funds.
Jack, you were talking about the opioid issue, and I just want to talk about maybe some of the people who serve this, because I don't, or get, are serviced by this, and I don't want them to necessarily be lost. So I mean just a quick list. I know it's both children and adults, and some really other vulnerable populations like veterans or those addicted to with substance abuse problems. So why don't you just go in, who's the main recipient of care in this program?
Well, I think you've identified there are many children. There are many single parents who don't have access to health insurance and who qualify economically. There are numerous individuals with disabilities, physical or behavioral health disabilities that prevent them from being able to hold full-time jobs and obtain insurance through an employer who then rely upon medical assistance for their health care benefit. And then more recently, with the Affordability Care Act, Pennsylvania opted into the opportunity to expand medical assistance to a group that falls just above the poverty level. Mm-hmm. That now individuals who fall between 100% and 138% of the federal poverty level can qualify for medical assistance in Pennsylvania. And so that has increased the number of individuals who we serve through our Health Choices program.
And one of the key points about that expanded population is that most of them are actually working. Mm-hmm. And so those are the folks that we have traditionally referred to as the working poor.
Sure.
So they're people that are working, but either their employer doesn't have to provide insurance, or they might be working part-time, two jobs, three jobs, and because of their part-time status, they're not eligible for employer-sponsored health care. So we really think that's been an important talking point with the Medicaid expansion, is literally the majority of the people that gained Health Choices coverage are actually employed.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you look at the total MA population, there's a misconception that there are many people that are unemployed. I think the majority actually do have a job. They just may not have access to insurance.
Yeah, we call it underemployed. Like I said, part-time or low-wage positions.
Sure. You know, on that point, I don't mean to catch you guys off guard, but is this program affected at all by the changes in the Human Services bill that's kind of running as part of the budget process here at the state at all?
Well, there's always, I mean, it gets to be awfully complicated.
Yeah.
The fiscal code bill both addresses some federal state issues, like there's an item in the fiscal code bill about how we pay for certain facilities in the community with medical assistance funds or not.
Mm-hmm.
It's called IMD, Institutes for Mental Disease. I don't like that term, but it's a term from the 1960s.
Sure.
That still survives. But in any event, part of the fiscal code was trying to address a concern about actually increasing Medicaid reimbursement to eligible people in Pennsylvania because of a change at the federal government level. Some of the things about the work requirement, you know, I leave it up to the administration officials to sort that out. But like I said, it's the evidence and the data is that the majority of people are already working. And so, you know, we kind of question some of the benefits of some of the items in the fiscal code bill. But many of them are aimed at either trying to, you know, in some of them, like I said, trying to address a certain federal state issue that has popped up over the last couple of years about reimbursement for some facilities.
Sure. You know, how do you, you're 20 years in, how do you expect the next 20 years to go, and what do you think is going to be important in carrying out this program for the near future?
Well, since I work in the drug and alcohol field, it's tough for me to see past the current opioid epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm seeing a current challenge that we're addressing and working on, but I think it will be with us for a few years to come, and that is to expand access to all forms of substance abuse treatment, but in particular medication-assisted treatment as a best practice in dealing with opiate addiction. And so I think we'll continue to look for ways to do that through our local Health Choices program.
Right, and I think sort of long-term from a mental health perspective, mm-hmm. it's sort of two main factors. One is, like Jack talked about and mentioned before, implementing evidence-based practices. The science of treatment evolves and has evolved for the last 40, 50 years. And so the challenge is often to get research-based treatment methods implemented in the field. They are best practices and they're effective, but it takes a lot of work and a lot of energy and sometimes a lot of funding to get that research implemented in the field on a practical level. So that will remain a challenge. And then, again, I think it's like a long-term mm-hmm. issue of constantly trying to reduce the use of residential services for both adults and children in the system. They are expensive. They are geared towards what we call really high-need, high-acuity individuals. But I think the challenge is to try to do a better job with that really difficult-to-serve population, to continue to bend the cost curve. Because one of the phenomena we've seen is the growth of the program has continued, meaning sure. more people keep coming into the program. So to sustain our cost effectiveness, we also have to keep working on not necessarily the super utilizers, but people who have high needs.
Is there anything else you guys want to add to help, you know, explain what this program is or why it's necessary as we close it out here?
No, I would just reinforce that I think it's one of the wisest public policy decisions that's been made in Pennsylvania is when there was a recognition of the need to move to a managed care approach for medical assistance services, that there was also a recognition to take advantage of the systems that were already in place at the county level for mental health and substance abuse services. And I'll reinforce what Dan mentioned earlier. I think it's proven to be a very creative partnership between government and private industry with using the experience and knowledge of counties, but also teaming up with private managed care companies and taking advantage of their expertise with managed care principles.
Right, and I think, again, one of the best sort of features about it is locally based.
Mm-hmm.
And so consumers, families, residents of counties, they get to work with providers they're familiar with agencies they're familiar with people that are working and living in their communities. So that sort of locally managed, locally delivered service system is really effective for the residents of Pennsylvania.
Jason, I did want to clarify my affiliation. You introduced me as a representative of the County Commissioners Association. Dan
yeah.
and I are both representing CCAP today, but my position is as the Executive Director of the Cumberland Perry Drug and Alcohol Commission.
Okay, great. All right, perfect. Guys, I appreciate you you talking with us today, and best of luck.
Thank you.
Great, thank you. All right, well, that's Rotunda Ramblings for this week. And again, if you want to find more information about the stuff we write about, we have between 10 and 15, between 10 and an indefinite, I guess, number of new pieces of state government-related content each week. And you can check that out on theplsreporter.com. If you want to follow us on Twitter, we are at @theplsreporter. You can check out our Pittsburgh Bureau stuff on the Pittsburgh tab on theplsreporter.com, and they are tweeting as well at @PLSReporterPGH. And again, we're going to be keeping up on the budget stuff and whatever people are talking about regarding that, and making sure we continue to bring you that great content regarding the rest of the Pennsylvania government at all levels, state and local level, that is pertinent to you. So
Again, until next time, my name is Jason Gottesman, and you've been listening to Rotunda Ramblings. We will see you all very soon.